Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show is by the group Son of the Widow, which you may or may not know refers to the goddess Isis. She is the widow and her son is Horus. Well, I'm so glad to be back with you this week. Did you know I did a special show on Monday night to make up for being sick last month? Well, in case you missed it, you can catch it in the archives. Dr. Tom Roberts, author of The Psychedelic Future of the Mind, Enhancing Cognition, Boosting Intelligence, and Raising Values, well, he chatted with us about how research institutes are experimenting with psychedelic mushrooms to help psychological healing, to enhance our creativity, to improve our cognitive functions, and to induce sacred experiences. Then as we cross the threshold into the second half of the show, Carolyn Muir, author of Tantra Goddess, chatted with me about sexuality and passion as prayer. We talked about how sexual education and Tantra yoga are relevant to the sacred feminine. Oh, we talked about the nature of Shakti, sexual healing and awakening, and the Divine Feminine Institute for Men and Women. So I think you'll want to make sure you listen. And tonight, another good show for you. First up is Charlotte Cressy, an animal rights activist and educator who will be on a panel with me coming up soon at WorldFest in May in the San Fernando Valley. Well, tonight she's here discussing living as love, co-creation of a kind world through an embodied vegan feminist ethic, followed by John Michael Greer with a show topic of spiritual ecology and what mysteries it teaches us and how it's associated with magic. But first, you know, I don't usually ask for myself, and you know that's the case if you're a regular listener. I don't even use the show to promote my books much, but I wanted to ask my dear listeners for a few little favors. The first two are really easy. I hope you'll subscribe to my new blog. It's only out a few weeks. It's called Herstory with Karen Tate. I just posted an entry called Margaret Thatcher, Patriarchy in a Skirt. You can find it on Blogger, or I'm sure it will pop up in the search engine if you put Herstory with Karen Tate in it. Also, please go to my Voices of the Sacred Feminine Facebook page and like it. I'll even bribe you. Here's a chance for you to win a prize, a copy of my book, Walking an Ancient Path. If you're the first listener to go there and like Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio tonight on Facebook, and if you live in the United States, I'll send you a book absolutely free. How's that? I think it's a deal. And you know, three is a sacred number, so here is my third favor to ask of you. My publisher has about 1,000 copies of my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, left in inventory, and I have about 100 copies myself. And I'd really like to sell these all out so I don't have to keep paying my publisher fees to store these books. So if you're looking for a gift for a friend, think about giving them my book. Either buy it from me or from any bookseller. Or another idea I have is send me a donation of $20, and upon your request, in your name, I'll donate a book to a library or a worthy cause. I appreciate your consideration. If every one of my listeners bought one copy as a gift, oh, we could do this so quickly. So I thought I'd just, you know, put it out there. You just never know what we can accomplish together, right? Well, you probably know that sound. I have some stuff to share. Here are the bees buzzing around in my bonnet today. First of all, if you check out my personal Facebook page, you know I've been urging people to call and email the White House and demand President Obama forget this chain CPI idea that means cuts to people on Social Security and also veterans and the disabled. I'm so tired of our policies getting hijacked and pulled right into ultra-right-wing conservative territory because a few Republicans who don't represent the majority of Americans are throwing a tantrum and holding the government hostage. President Obama has said on more than one occasion, politicians have to be pushed. So let's push President Obama and all our Democratic representatives. Call and email them. Tell them no cuts to Social Security, no chain CPI. Democrats supporting these cuts will be primaried and voted out of their cushy jobs in government if they support this. you know what, we will take a page out of the Tea Party playbook, and we know how afraid Republicans are of their base. Let's make our party afraid of our voting power, too. If they vote to cut Social Security, we vote them out of office. There are story after story after story that people get so little money from Social Security, and this is not charity, this is money that they earned and they put in for all their lives. By the time they pay their medicine, by the time they pay their rent, they're living the rest of the month on $3, $4, $5, $10, which is incredible, and they want to cut it even further. This is immoral. So if you're not sure what to say when you write or call, here are some ideas. Budgets are moral contracts, and it's immoral to ask the people with the least, the people who have been suffering the most, the poor, the elderly, and middle class, who have been steadily losing economic ground, to sacrifice more. Again, it is downright immoral. It would worsen the already huge income disparity in this country and usher in a wave of austerity like people in Europe are suffering through. Tell them don't dare touch Social Security or Medicare unless they close tax loopholes for the rich, make corporations pay their share of taxes, put an end to corporate welfare like all the subsidies the oil companies get, and slash the bloated military-industrial budget of the Pentagon. I called the White House switchboard yesterday, and they are being bombarded with calls. You will not be the only one calling. Everyone is outraged about this, but you need to lend your voice to this as well. We need numbers. So stand up, fight back, find your sacred roar. Don't you dare just roll over and say it's hopeless. Don't you dare. Well, there is some good news out there that came out last week, in case you missed it. A judge ordered the morning after pill available without prescriptions. It will be available to people of any age. The order overturned a 2011 decision by Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius to require a prescription for girls under 17. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommended last year that oral contraceptives be sold over the counter in an effort to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies in the United States. Friday's order came in response to a lawsuit launched by the Center for Reproductive Rights to help all women purchase them without a prescription. As one person commented on the article, and I wholeheartedly agree, Marika said, "Well, it's about time. Here in Canada, it's already available without prescription. This is not an abortion pill. It's a high-dose birth control pill designed to prevent pregnancy from happening." She says, "Would you prefer your tax dollars going to raise a welfare child because some baby's daddy refused to pay for his child support or for an abortion, or a female having access to an inexpensive pill that prevents unwanted pregnancy? Well, the latter is a better choice, don't you think? And what about if a girl is raped or the condom breaks? Because those things all happen. A female should have the right to protect herself from an unwanted pregnancy." Well, Marika, you don't have any arguments from me here. We're on the same page. Also, listeners, the chat room is now open if you'd like to post a comment or a question for my guests. And one last announcement, important stuff. Scholar, activist, and artist Lydia Rule, who has been a guest on the show and a dear friend of mine, received a Lifetime Achievement Award this week. The University of Northern Colorado's Graduate School is celebrating a century of scholars from 1913 to 2013, and Lydia Rule was one of the recipients for her art and goddess scholarship. I can't think of a person more deserving. Lydia has been a dedicated teacher and artist, a supporter of her sisters, a political activist, and not just for women's rights, but she's been dedicated to rebirthing goddess into our society, goddess values. So congratulations, Lydia. For more information on Lydia and her art, please check out lydiarule.com. See her beautiful goddess icon spirit banners, which she lovingly refers to as her girls, which have been ambassadors across the globe for years, bringing the essence of the sacred feminine into many places she might not have otherwise gained entry. Okay, well, it's time for our first guest, so let me thank Charlotte Cressy for her patience while I shared the aforementioned with you. And let me tell you a little bit about this fantastic young woman before we start our chat. Charlotte is an animal rights activist and educator, a certified yoga and meditation instructor, a feminist, a lover of life, an enthusiast for the many benefits of a vegan lifestyle. She believes in the revolutionary power of love, and she challenges the notion that the world is cruel. Her approach to social justice is grounded in uprooting the source cause of cruelty perpetrated against animals, women, and other oppressed groups, and that oppressor is the dominator paradigm. She views veganism and treating all animals with respect as part of a larger goal to create a peaceful world for humans, animals, and the earth. And her website is veganwellness.net. So, Charlotte, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. Welcome.
Thank you, Karen. I'm so honored to be here. And first of all, I just want to thank you for being you and for all the wonderful things that you do, for your activism, for your writing, for this show. I think that your work is so crucial to creating that kind of world that we all wish to see. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You're so sweet. You know, we're all just doing our little part because, man, you know, there's so many things out there that need to be fixed. It's going to take all of us to make it right.
Absolutely.
So listen, let's start with, you know, sort of the overarching idea here. You say that the dominator paradigm is the cause of all of these issues. You talk about the connection between veganism and feminism. Let me just sort of throw that out to you, and, you know, maybe you can give listeners, you know, sort of a, you know, in a nutshell idea of where we're going, and then we'll sort of, you know, get down into specifics.
Yes, fantastic. So the dominator paradigm is the mindset that turns beings into things. So it's the way of relating to others where we look at another being and we say, what can I get from you? How can I profit from you? What can I extract from you? Instead of how can we mutually coexist and both get our needs met? And so we see this mindset in the way that we relate with other people, in the competitiveness that we experience, not just personally, but with the economic systems and ideas that we have about what it means to be successful. And then we see this in the way that we treat animals and women. Women are turned into objects, and animals are also turned into objects. The dominator paradigm is another word for patriarchy, and it's really about identifying the mindset, the cultural beliefs, and the systems that we've all internalized and may actually not be aware of, that through the dominator paradigm, we actually turn beings into things, and we, because of that, we disconnect from the reality of what is being done to them. So we have, out of the dominator paradigm, we have this thing that I call disembodied logic. So it's the mindsets that justify violence against animals and women, because to actually cause harm to another being harms us, and it doesn't really feel good to be causing all this harm to all these animals that we consume and to turn women into objects. But in order to do that, we have this disembodied logic. It's the realm of the mind, and that's where all the ideas that we have about others that turn them into different than us. So,
well, and I think what you're talking about, Charlotte, you know, we can look at it in so many different ways. You know, what you're talking about, this dominator paradigm, this power over paradigm, this you are here for my benefit paradigm, you know, it goes back to the Bible, really. I mean, it goes back to the idea that man is, you know, woman is here to serve man, nature is here for the use of man. And, you know, rather than with like goddess ideals where everything is sacred, we are interconnected. It's more of a partnership amongst everyone rather than this dominator idea where, you know, we have this authoritarian God who gives who gives rights to men to dominate the world and the beasts and the environment, and look what's happened. You know, we have, so many of us have grown up with this being the norm because goddess ideals have been swept under the rug, but it wasn't always like this. This is not the norm. This isn't the way it's always been and the way it doesn't have to be.
Absolutely, I agree. But one of the key things that I think many of us in the feminist and goddess movement leave out is the animals. And even though we talk about this, the dualisms and that we want to include animals, we often have this idea that we can use animals in a humane way. And so I would like to really emphasize that patriarchy started with the herding of animals. So may I explain that briefly?
Absolutely.
Okay, so humans are natural herbivores, and we adapted to scarcity when we moved away from the equator. We started off by being scavengers, kind of like vultures and hyenas do. We would follow around carnivores, and we would eat some of their scraps. And then we developed hunting and tools and all those things, and that helped us get through the Ice Age. And then later on, we actually started herding animals, and I think that is a place we really want to look at. It was the advent of animal agriculture. That's the beginning of the dominator paradigm. Because in order to herd animals, we had to disconnect ourselves from our natural empathy. And the way that we actually started herding them was by following them around, befriending them, and then really betraying them. And so killing the parents and keeping the babies. And I think in order to do that, that causes a real disconnect from our empathy. And then also in order to keep animals for animal agriculture, we have to restrict their mobility. So that requires some kind of force against them, and that's where you develop the dominator mindset. So two things come out of herding animals. One is that you have to restrict their mobility, so you usually will beat them multiple times a day, and that causes us to numb and block out our feelings because it doesn't feel good to cause harm to other beings. In fact, ourselves, when we see another being experiencing pain, we actually naturally feel empathy and feel that pain as well. So as a result of hurting animals, we learn to disconnect from our empathy and disconnect from the reality of feelings in our body. And then secondly, we developed a whole mindset and all these cultural stories to justify the cruelty that we inflict on animals. So that's where we see the dualism come up, where animals, women, nature, and earth are all degraded. And that's why we have the words for animals that are really insults, like chicken, oh, you're a chicken, or you're a cow. And then with women, we have many slanderous names toward women, which I'm sure people can think of off the top of their heads without me saying them, that insult women as well. And so we see how animals and women are degraded as a result of herding animals, because after animals became property, then women became property too. And
well,
then
let's talk a minute, and I want to go back to that, but you made such a crucial point. You said we disconnect from our empathy, and I think once we disconnect from our empathy, it's almost possible for us to do anything, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, domestic abuse, or whether we're talking about cheating our neighbor or starting a bogus war because, gee, those people on the other end of the other side of the world, they're faceless. We don't know who they are. You know, they're subhuman. They don't count because I'm the only one with my needs that counts. You know, or even what's going on in our country today, the lack of empathy for the poor, the lack of empathy for immigrants, the lack of empathy for people who don't have their civil rights. You know, so really when you think about it, a disconnect from your empathy causes tragic consequences in so many different spheres of our life.
Absolutely. Yeah, we tend to, in all those situations you just mentioned, we tend to emphasize the differences that we have from those groups of people. And it's the same thing with animals. We think that animals don't have feelings, that they're more instinctual. And the reality is that animals do matter, and that to any animal, her or his suffering feels just as real to them as ours does to us.
Well, you know, I think everybody, I have to admit, I have been trying very hard to eat less meat, but I'm not a vegetarian yet. And I honestly, you know, I've been able to bring myself to look at some of the video footage, you know, people like Mercy for Animals and other groups like that have out there of these factory farms. And you know what? If that were put on the news once a week or once a month, I think if everybody saw that, it would make a huge difference. Instead of, you know, a big agri, you know, agribusiness, corporations hiding it from us because they don't want people to know the reality of these poor animals suffering. And, you know, I would urge listeners, if you have a dog or you have a cat or whatever your, you know, your beloved pet is, you know that pet feels pain. You know how that animal feels when you love it. These other animals are no different.
Absolutely. I think it is about exposing what's really going on, and not just factory farming, but the reality is that any time we use an animal for our own purposes, her or his needs are not at the top of our list of priorities. And so I believe that any time we use an animal, that is abuse. Therefore,
yeah,
I'm working toward doing away with all animal products and all use of animals, because one of the responses of the dominator culture has been, oh, well, we'll offer you free range and cage free products and things like that. But those, first of all, those all involve a ton of egregious abuses. But even in the most, what we would consider the most ideal situation, we're still restricting the mobility of animals, choosing who they get to live with. And most importantly to me is that all animals are sexually violated in order to keep them producing.
Maybe
in
you
fact,
better
farmers,
explain that one.
Okay, so in order to keep animals producing, we force them, we force them to breed. And farmers actually, for cows, they call it the rape rack. And with chickens, the male chicken is eager to fornicate, and in nature, if there would be a courtship and some kind of decision as to when they would actually breed. But in farms today, the breeder, the female breeder chickens are confined so that she can't get away. And if you Google and look up pictures of them, you can see that they don't have any feathers. They're all, their flesh is all exposed and pink because they're so abused and they're raped basically, and they only live a few months because their bodies just can't take it.
Oh,
so,
Charlotte, that's terrible. I really didn't know that. That's horrendous.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you think about it, even with companion animals, they're always, you know, force-bred pretty much. And then with cows, they are they don't use other cows. With cows, a farmer actually puts his fist into the cow's anus and then syringe is inserted in the vagina, and that's how she is impregnated, which is another form of rape, I think.
Wow. So, all right, well, I interrupted you before. Do you remember where we left off? I think you were talking about, you know, maybe it was how, you know, women are domesticated and animals are domesticated, how maybe that's related. Was that where you were going?
Well, we could certainly go there. Yeah, so within patriarchal culture, women and animals are both defined in how they serve men. So women are supposed to be pleasing, decorative objects, sexual objects, caretakers, and mothers. And animals are meant to please the senses of people. So women and animals, I'd say they're domesticated because they're not really free to be their full wild self, right? Even look at our beauty practices for women. We have to shave and put on makeup. And I'm not saying that we should, that we have to do away with all those. I think that each person can define their own, what they consider appropriate decoration. But I think it's a problem when the culture tells us that we have to look a certain way. And when it's enforced on us so much that, you know, they did a study of seventh graders that showed that over 70% of them would rather be hit by a bus than be overweight.
Mm.
And that's where women have internalized their inferiority. And I think that's the biggest block to the realization of feminist goals and to a truly emancipated world, and also a block to creating the vegan world that we wish to create, because women's energies are just getting sucked down the drain. I know mine have, with, you know, internalizing that focus on appearances and am I good enough and all those thoughts that tend to go through our heads.
Right. Well, you know, you think about all of the money that women spend with cosmetic surgeons, you know, Botox, breast augmentations. You know, we were laughing in a class we had recently. There's even something now called anal bleaching, because heaven forbid that area of your body can't be a little bit darker skin than the rest of you. I mean, there's vaginal rejuvenation. It's really insane. I mean, facelifts, all of this to sort of live up to a patriarchal idea of beauty, you know, rather than, I mean, we're not saying women can't be the best that they can be or women can't be healthy, but I think it's really gone to the extreme with all the eating disorders and all of that. And you see models, basically, you know, who come down the runway, you know, if these are the role models for girls, I mean, these models look like young boys. You know, they don't look like real women. And what pressure that puts on women, you know, to live up to these unnatural standards.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think it's also, part of it is also coming from pornography and the normalization of the sexualized female body.
Well, do you want to get into that a little bit? Because, you know, pornography is a huge issue that really sort of sets women back, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, think about what you were just talking about. Think about how much more energy we would have. And like I say, I'm not blaming other women, because this is something I struggle with myself, trying to figure out what beauty standards do I want to participate in, what, you know, beauty practices, and what do I not. So I think it's something we have to think about on a personal level, but also to join together on a collective level in challenging that, no, you do not define me, you know, the patriarchal dominator mindset, like identifying where that's coming from and choosing to not participate and choosing to be self-defining and self-referring, instead of just feeling like we have to take it all in and conform accordingly.
Right. So, I know there's probably more you wanted to say about the pornography, but did you want to, you know, was there any more you wanted to say about, you know, the oppression of animals? I mean, I know you wanted to, you know, probably punctuate the fact that, I'm one of them. I admit I'm guilty. You know, when we talk about the feminist ideals, you know, we don't always think to include, the suffering of animals. But the suffering of animals really sort of lays the foundation for oppression in the world, doesn't it?
Yes, it absolutely does. Like I was talking about before, it was the advent of animal agriculture that patriarchy grew out of. And so definitely, I think, to go back to the porn issue, basically women and animals are turned into consumable objects. So animals are consumed literally, and women are consumed visually and sexually. So both of these normalize violence, and they normalize using other beings. So pornography is a huge problem, just like the slaughterhouses. It's invisible. It's something that people consider a private choice, a private matter, but it's not. It's totally political, and it affects us all. In fact, 25% of all searches on the Internet are pornographic, 12% of websites are pornographic, and these are coming from Gail Dines. I highly recommend her book, Pornified. So if you want to learn more, I recommend reading something by Gail Dines, D-I-N-E-S. And the problem with pornography is that people like to say that it's liberating, but it's not. It's really confining, because it's really formulaic and devoid of true creativity. It's not about two people connecting. It's always the same formula. It's always someone dominating, taking and extracting pleasure from another person. And part of the arousal is in degrading the person who's the submissive, usually the woman. And I see this as a huge problem as an animal rights activist, because people, mostly men, are getting aroused by violence. And they actually, by watching pornography, they learn to get turned on by violence. So then when we show them one of those videos that you were talking about, Karen, like an undercover investigation of the farm, an animal farm, then when we show them one of those, they're going to think, so what? I watched porn and I think that's, you know, I'm used to that by now. That's kind of what might be going through their minds. So
they're kind of becoming desensitized, I think, is maybe what you're
exactly.
saying. Well, and I think one of the phrases you used in some of the information you sent me was, all of this is examples of institutionalized violence in a way, whether we're talking about the food industry or the porn industry. I mean, you know, these are industries that make bundles of money. And, you know, God, you know, if we had conservative Republicans, you know, their hair would be on fire, you know, because we're talking about, you know, sort of restricting freedoms. But at the same time, you know, I think you have to look at what your actions are contributing to.
Right. Yeah. Institutionalized violence, it's not just the corporations who are to blame, but it's each of us who participate in perpetuating it through our language, the way that we speak about women. Even when people say mankind, that's not correct. Unless you're speaking about men, you know, humankind would be the proper word. And so we have to look at, with the institutionalized violence, what are the cultural stories that we're telling about women and animals, and how are our individual choices impacting the lived experience of women and animals and all groups of people?
So, Charlotte, do you think it's realistic, though, that I think about here in the United States, you know, we're such huge meat eaters, you know, we're kind of meat and potatoes people. I mean, realistically, do you think we can make progress in any meaningful way, you know, to sort of limit the meat and poultry consumption of Americans?
Absolutely. And I really hope that it comes about in the next few years from an ethical standpoint. However, everyone will be vegan by 2070, because we absolutely cannot continue to eat animals just for the environmental reasons. So if I have a minute to explain why I say that, I would love to.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, okay. So the human population is, you know, increasing exponentially, and there's no way that we can support the human population eating animals, because eating animal products is the number one cause of environmental degradation. Whatever it is, whatever issue we're looking at, whether it's water, deforestation, air pollution, animal agriculture is such a big polluter. And if you just think about cycling, okay, so you can get all these nutrients from plants directly, but instead we cycle them through animal bodies. So those animals eat those plants, and then those animals, you know, have excrement, which is released into the earth. And then those animals are transported around, and then all the energy that goes into slaughtering them. So I'll just give you a few statistics here to show the enormity of both the problem of animal agriculture as well as the enormous solution that veganism really does present to us. Okay, so a lot of people want to conserve water, for example, and people talk about low-flow shower heads and things like that. But really, the number one use of water is livestock production. In fact, more than half of all water used for all purposes in the U.S. goes to livestock production. So let's look at the average person's diet. The average meat eater's diet uses 4,000 gallons of water per day. The average ovo-lacto vegetarian, someone who eats dairy and eggs but no flesh, uses 1,200 gallons of water per day, and the average vegan diet only uses 300 gallons of water per day. So we're talking about 300 versus 4,000.
Wow.
And then, yeah, and then another example is animal excrement. The animals used for food produce 130 times the amount of excrement of the human population. So that's going directly into our waters. And then the use of land. So if we have 2.5 acres of land, that can support 1 or 2 people eating animals, or 17 to 23 people eating vegetables.
Wow.
So as the human population is increasing, to get back to your question, I think that we will absolutely, out of necessity, be going into, you know, eating more and more plants. And then I think that once we stop eating animals, then we're able to think about these things, because sometimes, you know, think about the ethical implications, because sometimes when you're actually consuming animals, it's hard to really wrap your mind around all the harm that's caused to these beings, because we have to stay in denial, because sometimes it makes us feel so bad to think that we're contributing to that.
But, well, and anybody who's driven, driven past, well, I'm trying to think what you call them. I know when I was driving up the 5 to San Francisco not that long ago, we passed one of these places where it's like a holding area for cows before they're shipped off to the slaughterhouse. Talk about incredible stench. Talk about a depressing place. I mean, honestly, I think probably after we drove past that place, I don't think I ate meat for a week. You know, I mean, just seeing, you know, the conditions, smelling the stench. We're so detached from that, because, you know, we go to our grocery store, you know, the meat is so, you know, beautifully colored and placed in the plastic packages. We just have a total disconnect about how it got there and the suffering it caused, you know, to produce this package, and the waste, you know, the waste of resources to produce this package of meat for us that we don't think twice, you know, really about consuming.
Exactly. Yeah, we forget that chicken leg we might be eating actually used to be someone's leg. Someone was actually walking on that leg. We don't think about that, and the entire language covers that up with words like beef and pork. And even if you say the word chicken to someone, they don't think of a chicken, you know, her whole body. They think of a piece of chicken.
Yeah.
So it's about reminding people of that. And another good news is that if you adopt a vegan diet, you can save 95 animals per year. So
wow.
What other choice can we make where we can save thousands of animals, or, you know, thousands of lives within our life? So,
well, and I know, you know, for people that might think, oh God, this is overwhelming, you know, or I just don't, you know, I don't like vegetables. How am I ever going to make the shift? I had a guest on from Mercy with Animals who said, you know what, just start with one day a week not consuming, you know, meat products or poultry products, just one day a week. And, you know, make an adventure out of exploring other alternatives, you know, other food alternatives. Because I'm a person who, you know, who was a big meat eater. Well, not so much a big meat eater, but I didn't like vegetables. And, you know, the thought of having to rely on vegetables for my entire diet was really overwhelming. But when you really start to get into it, it can really be delicious.
Absolutely, I agree. And I would say, sure, start with one day a week, but keep moving toward that goal. Don't get complacent, because for some people, gradual change is lasting change, and for others, they have to make a radical shift in order to stick with something. I know for me, I was already vegetarian, and then I went vegan overnight, and there was no going back. So I think it also depends on your personality, but there are so many wonderful resources out there. Now you can just go on Google and find tons of great recipes, and there's a wonderful organization for anyone who has questions about nutrition. It's called Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, P as in Peter, CRM.org, and they have a lot of information about nutrition and health and what to eat.
Charlotte, I'm getting a question from one of my listeners. They say, what's the difference between a vegetarian diet and a vegan diet?
Okay, so a vegetarian diet is no flesh, so no bodies. That means no fish, no chickens, no any bodies. But they would eat dairy and eggs. And then a vegan diet is no animal products. So that's no dairy, no eggs, no honey, and no meat as well. And then some people, like me, who are vegan, choose to avoid all animal products as much as possible. So that's leather, wool, silk, and, you know, different skin
products.
So,
Charlotte, for somebody who, you know, this is really new to, I mean, here in California, you know, this is a popular thing, but believe me, I come from Louisiana. It's not... this well known everywhere, trust me. Why don't you say what you would eat in the normal course of a day? What do you eat for breakfast? What do you eat for lunch? What do you eat for dinner?
Sure. So the four food groups, according to PTRM, are vegetables, fruits, grains, and legumes. So legumes are like beans, basically. So for breakfast, I'll either have a green smoothie or oatmeal. In my green smoothie, I'll put fruits and some kind of greens and blend it up. Or I might have oatmeal with some raisins, maybe a little bit of some kind of spice, turmeric or cinnamon, and sometimes sunflower seeds. And then for lunch, I'll always have a grain and some kind of legumes. So maybe some steamed kale, some rice, and kidney beans. And then for dinner, a similar thing, and I know, well, my meals sound kind of boring, but you can have like enchiladas and pasta and any other thing that people would usually, you know, the non-vegan meals. You can veganize almost anything, but just for the sake of simplicity, I just do my beans, grains, and legumes and eat some fruit throughout the day.
Well, and you know, and there's so many reasons to do what you're talking about. You know, as a feminist, it's the ethical thing to do, because if we're worried about oppression of women, we should be also worried about the suffering of animals and the environment that suffers because of the factory farming and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, it's a good thing to do because of our health. It's a good thing to do if you're an environmentalist. I mean, just all around, there are more reasons to, you know, go vegetarian or go vegan than to not, really, when you think about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially we didn't get to go into the feminist thing that much, but I'll just emphasize that female reproductive systems are exploited in the animal agriculture industry. That's what they're founded on. If you think about dairy and eggs, can you imagine giving birth, having your baby taken away from you so someone else can drink your milk, having a machine connected to your breast, and then when you're no longer and forcibly impregnated every year, and that baby keeps getting taken away each year, which causes a lot of grief, and then when you're not producing enough, you're going to get slaughtered. So it's not a nice life. And then think about chickens. We're taking basically their reproductive cycles, their menstrual cycles, and we're eating their eggs. It's kind of a strange thing to do.
Well, and you know what I'm thinking about here too is, you know, this whole idea of, you know, and then maybe you should go into it a little bit more because we do still have some time. You know,
okay.
this idea of the feminism, you know, with the veganism, you know, how it's, you know, how it is actually more tied together.
Okay, well, feminism is an emancipatory theory aimed at freeing all people and all beings from all forms of oppression. And to me, feminism is about reestablishing values of love. And the values that I consider to be of love are cooperation, compassion, care, peace, community, and coexistence. So the opposite of those values, the values that patriarchy is founded on and through which women are oppressed, are power over, turning women and certain groups of people into things, and it's the same mindset that we use when we use animals. So animals are turned into things. Animals are degraded. And if you look at the duality, the patriarchal dualities, we have women and then men and then animals and humans and then emotion, reason, you know, all of those things that group together, things that are close to the earth and that are instinctual, emotional, all those things are degraded. But emotions, compassion, caring, all those things that have been identified as feminine and therefore unimportant in patriarchy are really going to be our saving grace. And so I think it's really important that we not only use the feminist mindset to reclaim the value of women, but also to look at other areas where we can shine some love and to uplift all beings. And so with ecofeminism or whatever you want to call it, it's not about finger-pointing and blaming, and it's not even about blaming men. It's about identifying the cultural systems so we can lift everyone up, because the dominator paradigm harms everyone. Even though the people at the top may seem to benefit, and even though people might think that the oppressor is benefiting, it's actually harming him as well. Because our true power as humans is when we're grounded in love and when we're in relationships that empower both people or both beings, that's really where our power is. And I think that we feel better about ourselves when we are living as love and living it with kindness toward animals. I think that people who adopt the vegan diet, they notice this shift in the way that they relate to other animals. And I think that we still do not know the full potential of humanity because we have not all embraced this way of relating to other animals. You know, we're trying to figure out new economic systems, new ways of relating to each other. But I think that now that women are being included, and once we start recognizing animals' inherent worth as well, we're going to see some really amazing possibilities of how we can continue to thrive on this planet.
I think you've made some incredibly good points, Charlotte. And you know, and I love this connection between the veganism and the feminism. You know, I actually had somebody email me once and say, you know, why don't you talk more about animal rights? And I actually did, you know, start getting more guests on that would sort of make these connections. But you've done a wonderful job tonight. And you know, talking about this idea of love and compassion, you know, what I often wonder, I mean, obviously this isn't something that we can measure. We can only maybe think about intuitively or anecdotally or something. But I wonder about ingesting an animal that has suffered so badly. You know, I wonder if you know, there's, you know, I don't know if there's a dis-ease about that, you know. I mean, I know we always hear about the horrible things the animals in factory farms are fed, the antibiotics because the conditions that they live in are so deplorable, you know, they don't want them to get sick. But that's one issue. But another issue too is, you know, if you're consuming an animal that has suffered its entire life, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, can that be good for the person ingesting that animal? I don't know. Does that sound crazy?
I'm so glad you asked because I agree 100%. I think that if you're consuming death and misery, because that's what it is, then that's going to affect your body. And I'm not talking just about the adrenaline that's in the meat and all those stress hormones, but actually the energetic of the food. And another point I wanted to make is that children don't naturally eat meat. When I was 3 years old, I wanted to stop eating animals, and I told my parents this because animals are my friends. And I think that most children do not want to eat animals. There's this quote that if you put a young person and a baby and an apple in a room, if you put a baby in a crib with a bunny rabbit and an apple, the baby will eat the apple and play with the bunny rabbit, because that's just what comes naturally to us, is you don't naturally want to eat animals. A lot of children don't want to. And it's only the indoctrination of the culture that teaches them that this is what we do. We just have to numb ourselves off from our feelings. This is just how it is. And I think that's really the beginning of justifying all kinds of violence and the other institutionalized forms of violence. We learn to be willing to turn a blind eye and not listen to our compassion because we're ingesting violence three times a day. I think that killing is unnatural for humans. Killing is a maladaptive behavior. And the way that we're able to have all these wars and all the rapes and violence against women is because we have a really powerful system that keeps us hooked on violence, and that is consuming animals three times a day.
Well, when you think about it, because we're, quote, a rich country, we can afford, generally to eat animals three times a day. Imagine if the entire world were a rich country and, and they were also consuming animals three times a day. We would really be messed up. But fortunately, some of these other countries, they're more, I don't know, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't actually researched this. I mean, I'm just going from what I think might be common sense. But, these countries, in Africa or China, where they eat a lot of rice and grains, and, they can't eat meat every day, at every meal. They just don't, they aren't able to. So in a sense, our richness has really not only hurt us psychologically because of this connection with institutionalized violence and our lack of empathy and what was the phrase you used, the cognitive disembodied logic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I mean, it's almost as if our wealth has sort of set us back as human beings in a way. These poor countries are really maybe more closely aligned with the right thing to do. I guess I don't know how else to say it.
Well, I think that there are still patriarchal structures that are based on using animals, so I don't know that they have more compassion for them. But you're right that they traditionally, the cultures you were talking about, would use meat more as like a condiment, so mm-hmm. it would be a very small part of their meal. But mm-hmm. the scary thing is that with globalization, more and more animal products are being consumed. And as of right now, for every 1 acre of land cleared for shopping malls, parking lots, and other new construction, 7 acres are being cleared for livestock.
Wow. Are there any statistics, Charlotte, that shows we're making progress? Or, I mean, do we know, is this something that can be measured?
I should look that up. I did hear from someone recently, but I didn't verify it. She says that vegans have gone from, we're 2% of the population in the U.S., and she said we've gone up to 5% in the past few years, but I'm not sure about that. And like I said, I think it will be the environmental crisis that gets everyone to go vegan, but worldwide animal products are on the rise. So I am seeing changes here in the U.S. with more and more vegan restaurants opening, more discussion about it. When I first became a vegan in 1996, it was unheard of. People didn't know what it was, and we had to go to health food stores to get soy milk. Now, soy milk and all kinds of vegan products are in all the grocery stores. So we are seeing major change here in the U.S., but worldwide, with the westernization, they're increasing consumption of animal products.
Well, and I think it's a regional issue, too, because, I think in some places, like here in California, there's more awareness. But, I mean, when I go back to New Orleans, you can't even find, like a spring mix lettuce. You find, iceberg lettuce. You can't find, vegan restaurants. I mean, these things are just not catching on in a lot of places around the country. You know, I don't know what it'll take. Like you said, maybe it'll take the environmentalism. You know, they'll be forced to. But I think a good way in the meantime to convince people, because you know people won't always do the right thing, but people will do the selfish thing, unfortunately. So if you continue to tell them the health benefit, you know, whatever you have to do to get them to change, but even if they do it for the health benefit, at least in the process, you know, the animals are getting a break, the environment is getting a break. So,
absolutely, I agree. And I'd like to emphasize that no matter where you live, if you have access to vegetables, fruit, grains, and beans, you don't need all the fancy. I don't eat a lot of the, you know, the highly processed, like, vegan, all the vegan, you know, great foods that we have. We have vegan ice cream and all these things now. So you don't need to eat, you don't need those things to be vegan. It's nice, and it makes it easier for making the transition, but you certainly don't need them in order to be vegan. So even if you live in a rural area that doesn't have these specialized products, you can certainly do it.
Well, you are so well informed, Charlotte, and you have thought of all the different questions, and you have an answer for everything, and I think that's fantastic. Well, we don't have too much time left. I'm waiting for my second guest on Spiritual Ecology to show up on the switchboard. So until he does, we still have a little bit more time. And we haven't really talked yet about the myth of humane animal agriculture. We sort of went there but then didn't. Did you want to talk about that a little bit, or were there any other points we haven't really hit on that you think you know, is important to talk about before we, you know, close the show tonight?
Yes, yes, I would love to talk about the humane myth. So Alice Walker said that the animals of the world exist for their own reasons. They were not created for humans any more than blacks were made for whites or women were made for men. That's the bottom line when it comes to animals. They're not here for our use. So anytime that people talk about humane meat or humane any animal product, it's always based on the idea that they're here for us to use. And we have this fantasy of some family farm that existed in some era that was kind to animals. But you know what? That kind family farm never existed. Because, like we were talking about earlier, anytime you use an animal, they're always sexually violated. So they're always forcibly impregnated. And in addition to that, their mobility is restricted. So, like we were talking about earlier, in herding cultures, they had different methods to restrict the mobility. Some of them would be hitting the animal with a stick multiple times a day. Now, would you want to be one of those animals whose all of your life choices are decided by this person? You're everywhere you want to go, all those things, and then you end up getting killed. So that's one part of it. And there's also more cruel methods to restrict mobility that were used by herding cultures, like cutting the eyes out of animals so that they couldn't go very far.
Oh, that's horrible. Well, and I mean, I know right now they stack chickens in cages, you know, like I don't even know how high, but it's just cage on top of cage on top of cage. And, you know, to get the veal, you know, they put the, you know, poor little animals in these tiny little pens so that they don't move, so that the meat is tender. I mean, it's really horrendous stuff. So I guess what you're telling me, even when I go into Whole Foods, and I see these different charts on the meat counter that says, you know, these animals lived a more humane life than these animals over here, it's malarkey.
Right. Yeah. So one of the responses of the industries is to say, oh, well, that's just factory farming. And we are a humane farm. We don't have as many animals. And so I think it's really important to put ourselves in the animals' bodies and think about it. So if you have, let's say you have a sister, and I said, I'm going to keep her at my house, and she's not allowed to leave, but don't worry, I'll give her her favorite food, her favorite music, she can play her favorite instrument, but she can't leave. So she's enslaved, right?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, no matter how well you might think you're treating an animal, it's always taking away their autonomy. And, you know, to not be free to move your body and choose where you want to live, things like that, to me, are really, really foundational to give animals those freedoms. So the point isn't to have happier farms. The point is that we should do away with domesticated animals and do our best to leave wild animals their space so that they can live the lives that they choose.
Right. Well, I want to just make a couple comments that one of our guests just sent me in the chat room. She said, well, first of all, she likes the subject. She just tuned in, and she's going to go back and listen from the beginning. But she commented on what we were talking about, that society's karma from eating meat, you know, that's, you know, sort of an interesting thing. We, you know, we didn't talk about a whole lot, but it makes sense. And that, you know, she says that we were taught that animals didn't have feelings. You know, we kind of talked about that as well. Patriarchy has disconnected us from nature, man versus nature. So I want to thank my listener for sending these comments to it. To us. And Charlotte, I want to thank you too for, you know, for being with us tonight. I see my second guest, John is waiting on the switchboard here. But before I go, why don't you go ahead and give listeners your website again, and so that they can reach you, and, you know, if they want to talk to you more about it, or maybe have you come talk to their group or something like that, they'll know how to reach you.
Absolutely, yes. My website is veganwellness.net, V-E-G-A-N, wellness, W-E-L-L-N-E-S-S.net. And you can reach me on there. You can learn about the yoga and meditation and other things that I offer. And I also have a meetup group if you want to get active in Southern California for women and animals. The name of the meetup is Vegan Wellness. And we have some exciting events coming up, like Karen's talked about. We have World Fest. It's the largest Earth Day festival in Southern California, coming up May 19th. And then we have a wonderful vegan spirituality retreat in Malibu, June 1st, with author Will Tuttle. And he's going to be talking more about the karmic implications of eating animals and things like that, that one of your guests just commented on.
Mm-hmm.
So the vegan spirituality retreat is a really great opportunity. I'm sure there will be lots of goddess people there as well. So
okay.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Well, thank you so much. It was a wonderful show. I appreciate the work you're doing in the world. You know, keep it up. You know, it's like, you know, we have to be like water wearing away rock.
I agree. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good night.
Good night. Bye.
Well, listeners, we're about ready to cross the threshold into the second half of the show. And did you know International Mother Earth Day is coming up on April 22nd? This is not to be confused with Earth Day celebrations. This is a bit different and separate, but equally important. And I discovered this recently by looking at the United Nations website. I encourage you to go there as well. And I would love to meet you. If you're in the Southern California area, I will have a booth and be on a panel in the Health Hut for an event out here that Charlotte was just talking about, called World Fest on May 19th in the San Fernando Valley. You can hear me talking about Goddess Ideals for a Sustainable Future. In June, I'll be at the Long Beach Women's Spirit Fair with a booth. I hope you will come by and say hello. And please stay with me after my interview with John, which we're going to start here in just a moment, because after our interview, I have some important information to share. So I am going to unmute John and say hello. Welcome, John, to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, I want to start by introducing you a little bit to my listeners by way of your bio, and then we'll jump into our topic of spiritual ecology. So, listeners, John Michael Greer, he's been a student of the occult traditions and nature spirituality for more than 25 years. He's the author of numerous articles and more than 10 books, including natural magic, mystery teachings from the living earth, spiritual ecology, the new encyclopedia of the occult, the Druidry Handbook, and the Druid Magic Handbook. He's also the co-author of Learning Ritual Magic and Pagan Prayer Beads, and he lives in Cumberland, Maryland with his wife, Sarah. His website is aoda.org, aoda.org. And what does AODA stand for, John?
It stands for the Ancient Order of Druids in America, which
okay.
is a Druid order that I had.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, spiritual ecology.
Spiritual ecology.
Why don't you start out by telling us, define that for us. What do you mean by spiritual ecology?
Well, I think it'd be best if I talk around it just a little bit to sort of spiral into the definition.
Okay.
We have two different, broadly speaking, there are two bodies of knowledge, bodies of lore or information about the world that have come up through various channels in Western culture that has really stood against the radical division between nature and humanity, between the intellectual and the physical, that really pervades our culture. One of them is ecology. Since the emergence of scientific ecology in the middle of the 19th century, people have been doing research and discovering more and more that you cannot separate the physical. You cannot draw a hard line between humanity and nature. You cannot draw a hard line between the observer and the thing being observed. Of course, physicists have been figuring that one out too. But ecologists have been there first. And there's this entire body of systems theory, ecological thinking, very scientific, very thoroughly developed, but going in a direction that cuts across most of the biases that govern much of today's science. The notion of the isolated observer, that humanity is separate from the cosmos, and all this kind of stuff, which I'm sure you talked about in previous programs. Then there are spiritual traditions, occult and mystical traditions, of course, from around the world and across time, that also point out that human beings are fully embodied, fully embedded in the cosmos. We are not separate. We are not apart. We are a part of the cosmos, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me, as a student of both of these things, it became increasingly clear to me that they're talking about the same thing. They're two different ways of talking about the same basic intuition of belonging, of being part of the world, of being affected by the world and thus being affected by what we do to the world. We call this karma in certain spiritual traditions, Eastern-influenced spiritual traditions. In ecology, we call it like pollution.
Hmm.
I mean, you dump lots of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and your climate goes crazy.
This is
also, you know, straightforward scientific, unless you're being paid for by an oil company, it's really hard to miss.
Right. Makes perfect sense.
And so what I set out to do in my book, Mystery Teachings from the Living Earth, and more broadly in some of my works on the Druid tradition, is to begin to bridge the gap, the apparent gap between ecology, between scientific ecology, systems theory, our discursive scientific knowledge of nature, and the spiritual traditions. Because if they are talking about the same thing, it should be possible to get them to talk to each other.
Okay. And so with spiritual ecology, I guess you brought it all together.
With spiritual ecology, what I'm trying to do is talk about the basic concept of life in the world, the things that spiritual traditions have always talked about, and to do so using examples from ecology.
Okay, why don't you give us some examples?
Okay. Let's start with the basic notion that, we can use the one I was just using now, the idea of pollution, the idea of karma, the idea that what you do affects the whole system, and the whole system then affects you.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very common spiritual teaching. It's something you'll find in most spiritual traditions, and it's absolutely up-to-date ecological science as well, so that we can use examples from ecology. We can use anthropogenic climate change as a way to recognize that we also put out pollution, you know, when we fill our lives with negative and destructive thoughts.
We're creating our reality. We're creating our environment, basically.
Mm-hmm. We're polluting our mental atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And the results are just as bad as, you know, letting your tailpipe pump carbon dioxide out there into the atmosphere. And so that's an example. It's one example of many. And one of the things that I found in using this is that people get it. And they get it on a level that they don't necessarily get it when it's presented in the older metaphors of spiritual traditions. We're used to saying, oh, yeah, I shouldn't think negative thoughts. But when you can remind them, well, yes, this also works on the physical plane, we're very materialistic in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you point out, this works on the physical plane, this isn't just woo-woo.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a material reality. This is a testable scientific reality. Watch how it works in the world of matter. Now extrapolate from that. Now watch the same process at work in your emotional life, in your mental life, and so on. And the results have been, it seems to reach people. And so that's one of the things I've been working on.
Well, and taking it in the opposite direction, when we take that, you know, those toxic attitudes or toxic people out of our life and we don't contribute to pollution, you know, then we end up with this more pristine, healthy environment, whether we're talking about the, you know, whether we're talking about the environment or we're talking about our life. I mean, am I oversimplifying this or this is what you're saying?
No, it's precisely just as, you know, if you take the time to help clean up your physical environment, then you're going to have a better physical environment to live in. If you, I mean, just as an example, if you compost your kitchen waste, it's a minor thing. It's a little thing, but it means that things are going back into the cycle of life. It means that your garden's going to be richer. If you have a garden, you can, you know, put the compost in your house plants. One way or another, you're cycling stuff that would go into landfills and instead returns to ecological process. In the same way, you know, when you do constructive action in the world, you're basically composting it. And you're making a richer soil, if you will.
Right,
similarly,
right.
Positive emotions, positive thoughts, assessing your own actions and beliefs and against what actually works in the world. Yeah, you end up
so
with...
So it's almost like, you know, we're just using different language for the same thing, or we're using metaphors, you know, one metaphor, they're like, they're interchangeable, in a sense. So was there anything in particular that inspired you to write your spiritual ecology book?
Well, yes, actually there was, and it was kind of an odd experience. I as the head of a Druid order and a writer in the field of Earth spirituality, I go to various conferences and things. And at one point, I was at a conference at a beautiful Theosophical retreat center in Puget Sound, up in Washington State. And we were all asked. There were, I think, 30 or 40 of us there, people from different traditions. We were all asked to talk a little bit about what our tradition had to share, had to communicate to the body in general, to everybody who was there. And because I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, I started talking about limits. Okay, not. I mean, if you're familiar with much of New Age thought in recent years, by no means all, but much of it tends to take a very, very negative attitude toward limits. Limits are bad. You have to get rid of limits. They limit you, and so on. And I was talking about the other side. I was saying, you know, we're missing something here.
Well, if we think everything is, I mean, we don't have, I mean, resources are not infinite.
Thank
you. Know, so that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. But it's a crazy...
Well, unless they're talking about something else.
But in fact, it's a very, very popular craziness these days.
Because it's sort of like the idea of growth versus development. We can't keep growing and growing, but we can develop instead of continuing to try to grow.
Yeah, and part of developing is realizing that that's something that tapers out and completes. Just as a child grows to adulthood, it doesn't just keep on getting taller and taller and taller forever.
Yeah,
it reaches
maturity.
It develops into an adult and then goes on to live an adult life.
Right.
In the same way, that's moving toward a limit. That's embracing a limit. But when I said this, the temperature in the room must have dropped 15 degrees because people were going, oh, my God, limits. No, limits are bad. We can't have limits. It was funny. And so it was then that I really thought about the fact that we need to find a way to talk about these things that isn't hamstrung by the kind of unthinking growth philosophy of our culture.
Well, and what you're making me think about, too, it sort of maybe ties into this idea that's been sort of shoved down our throat for the last couple decades, that greed is good. Because I think that was a parallel idea.
Very much so. That's kind of the ultimate bottom level growth mentality, because if growth is good, then getting more stuff is good, then wanting more stuff is good, then greed is good. You have the basic anthem of the Reagan era.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Which
the ultimate consumers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's the only thing we're here on Earth for is
to consume
things to make some corporation rich.
Yeah, which is insane.
Right.
Just we can use that very straightforward terminology. It is insane. It doesn't make us happy.
No.
It
well, one of my listeners is asking me to say to you,
mm-hmm.
humanity has to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like we have another Earth waiting for us. You know,
exactly.
That Mother Earth has finite resources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I am delighted that your listener is clear on that, because so many people aren't. If you listen to the media, the mass media of these days, if you are so unfortunate as to have to, when they're yelling about the fracking bubble, it is a speculative bubble. It's being funded by Wall Street. They are packaging and flipping shale leases the way they were packaging and flipping real estate a couple of years back. And people are going nuts. They're saying, no, there are no limits to resources. We, as long as we keep investing capital, we can take more and more and more. And saying it with a straight face.
And do you think they really believe it?
I think some of them do. Well, the thing is, growth is our religion in this country.
Yeah.
Growth is a real. I mean, people say they're Christians or they say they're this. No, they're not. They believe in material growth. They believe in progress. They believe that we're just going to keep on zooming onward and upward with more and fancier gadgets to some kind of Star Trek future where we metastasize across the galaxy. And if you try to tell them that maybe that's not in the cards, it's like trying to tell a medieval peasant that heaven with God and the saints and angels isn't there anymore. You run into exactly that kind of blank religious faith that, you know, the Jetsons' future must be there for us.
Well, John, do you think, and I mean, look, I'm just asking your opinion,
mm-hmm.
obviously,
sure.
You know, there's not an answer, but mm-hmm. when I hear those sorts of people,
mm-hmm.
and I think these are probably the most unevolved, unaware people in the world, in a way, because...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's almost as if there's, you know, they shouldn't be the ones making these sorts of decisions because they're the least educated and the most shallow, and their values are just so out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's disturbing, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to think that so many people just don't get it, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they've deluded themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Into this idea that, you know, what you're talking about, you know, that there are no limits.
We can get something for nothing forever. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, let's look at our own community a little
mm-hmm.
bit, too. And I don't know whether you've experienced this, but one of my frustrations
mm-hmm.
is, you know, people in, and when I say the community, I'm using a real, you know, big umbrella, you know, because
mm-hmm.
I know
gotcha.
We're all, you know, different and we don't all have the same dogma. But
mm-hmm.
Something that really frustrates me is people who are into, say, earth-based spirituality,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have any conception of this either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll maybe support a political party who's,
mm-hmm.
you know, into corporations and fracking and, you know,
mm-hmm.
environmental destruction and misogyny of women and all of this
mm-hmm.
stuff. And they
mm-hmm.
don't see a disconnect between
mm-hmm.
what they profess their spirituality
mm-hmm.
is
mm-hmm.
and maybe their politics or how they
mm-hmm.
live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would
mm-hmm.
think we would be ahead of the curve, but I find that a lot of pagans aren't. You know, you know, maybe these libertarians who think, you know, they should
mm-hmm.
be able to do whatever they want. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you have any thoughts about that? I'm just wondering if you've experienced the same frustration.
Yes.
Or not.
Oh, yes. Now, to some extent, of course, the pagan community has had the huge disadvantage of becoming popular. And during the period, basically after... after Starhawk published Spiral Dance, after, Drawing Down the Moon by Margot Adler, and a couple of other books like that, right at the beginning of the 1980s, you had a lot of people piling into the pagan community because it was popular, because it was fashionable. And before Before then, it had been a great deal less so, and there was a lot less in the way of, people who wanted to get into it really had to work. And it's good that it got the more publicity. It's good that it got more of a public presence. It became possible to be publicly pagan to some extent in some parts of the country and be able to get away with it. But the downside is that you have people who join and then basically try to find a way to make what they've embraced fit the lifestyle they want to have, which Americans being Americans, and middle-class Americans especially, and so many of us in the pagan scene are coming from a middle-class background, amounts to an ordinary middle-class lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the same thing. I have friends who are devout Christians who say the same thing about the people, so many of the people in their churches, who will sit there and pray to Jesus on Sunday mornings and then ignore everything he said the rest of the week.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
So it's very common. The broader issue here, I think, and you actually touched on it very precisely, man, with that old mantra, greed is good. Because in the early 1980s, that was the period when America as a society turned its back on the green decade of the 1970s, turned mm-hmm. its back on the very real movement towards sustainability that had happened before then. Ronald Reagan was blathering at us, it's morning in America, and this kind of stuff. Sounded remarkably like Lippy the Lion. You must have noticed, Reagan sounded like Lippy the Lion, and George Bush first did the hearty har-har routine. It was bizarre.
Well, and speaking of Reagan, after we finish, I'm gonna read listeners something I just wrote on my blog about, mm-hmm. Margaret Thatcher, because they were thick as thieves. Thatcher, all mm-hmm. week long we've been hearing about how wonderful she was and how she's a role model for women. Well, she's just patriarchy in a skirt, as far mm-hmm. as I'm concerned, mm-hmm. All the suffering she caused her people. And this idea of this greed is good, we're seeing that play out right now.
Exactly.
Our own president, our Democratic president, is talking about chain CPI, which is going to hurt, poor people on Social
yes.
Security.
Of course. The thing is, when you say our Democratic president...
Well,
The Democratic Party sold out completely right around that same period of the 1980s because they were as much part of bailing out on their ideals as anyone else.
Yeah.
And now, unfortunately, they're having... who was it that described the Democratic Party as the place the progressive would go to die?
Well, and I get mad even when I listen to MSNBC. And, uh-huh. Today I heard Chris Matthews say, mm-hmm. those crazy extremists on the left... crazy extremists on the left from Chris mm-hmm. Matthews on MSNBC.
Of course.
If he's talking like that mm-hmm. because people like Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. are talking out against chain CPI, what hope do we have,
mm-hmm. We do have hope. We have a lot of hope, but it's not to be found in the political sphere, not now. The thing that happened in the early 1980s, and I watched this. I was at college at the time. I was studying environmental studies. And watching what happened as the green movement of the previous decade had its funding cut out from under it, and was sucked under by this immense cultural pressure to sell out and join the greed party,
mm-hmm.
and just wallow in all the stuff we had. And people knew it at the time that they were selling their future down the river. They knew at the time they were basically kissing off any hope that their children and their children's children would have a decent world. But it was so easy. And it was so popular. It was fashionable. John Denver was out. Madonna was in.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, when you talk to people who were around at that time, who sold out in that process, if you poke them at that, you get rage.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know they sold out.
Yeah.
And the Democratic Party the Republicans are at least, they at least have the courage of their convictions. Many of them have been convicted
yeah.
many times. But they actually believe what they say they believe. They believe
yeah.
the greed is good. They believe that the U.S. ought to go around stomping the rest of the world. And they say it. There's
yeah.
a certain honesty in that I respect.
Yeah.
the Democrats will say anything to get elected, and they'll do whatever the last Republican did.
Well, they're too wishy-washy. You know, honestly, I have a theory about it. It feels like to me the Republicans, you know, they have the strength of their convictions, but they're almost like they're rabid dogs.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the Democrats, they're so live and let live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they aren't passionate really about anything.
They don't actually believe in anything. They've sold out and they know it. So what are they going to stand for? Where the Republicans believe what they believe, I think they know in their guts that they're wrong, and that's where the rage comes from on their part.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at situations. I mean, come on, who's the guy? The guy who used to run the Whole Earth catalog, okay, Stuart Brand, who is now out there shilling for the nuclear industry.
Ah.
Insisting that we need lots of nuclear power. I mean, when he was editing the Whole Earth catalog, he could have explained immediately why it's a dumb idea to replace one kind of hideously dangerous polluting power with another kind of hideously dangerous polluting power. Okay?
Right.
He could have explained perfectly well that the problem is not that we have to have all of this vast extravagance of energy and stuff. It's that we use too much.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to scale back our desires to within the limits, there's that word again,
mm-hmm.
of the living earth.
Right.
And we can do it. I mean, we could do it easily. The average European uses a third of the energy per capita of the average American. They have, by most measures, a much better lifestyle.
Well, and not only that, I mean, you know, having been over there, I mean, they mm-hmm. have so much better, mass transportation.
Absolutely.
And I mean, they just do things so much mm-hmm. smarter than we
mm-hmm.
do.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we've been lazy and greedy, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we'll reap the whirlwind now.
Mm-hmm.
But
exactly.
So if you had a crystal ball.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see things changing, or what's going to cause it to change? I mean, will it just be utter collapse?
The change has to happen starting at the individual level. We have to start with our own lives. This is the thing that has caused things like the climate change movement. The climate change activism has been hamstrung because nobody's willing to actually make the cuts in their own lives, or not nobody, but almost nobody. Al Gore did an immense amount of damage to the movement he was trying to support with his frequent flyer miles and his
air conditioning. So he didn't live by example, you mean?
Exactly. You have to lead by example. People have been burned enough that they know that if somebody is saying, you need to give up your car and you need to do this, and they're not doing it themselves, they're just out. It's just a trip. They don't believe it.
Yeah.
And so, as it happens, for example, I don't own a car. I never have.
So how do you manage? I mean, you couldn't manage in California, but...
well, it depends on where you are. I live in a relatively small town in the north central Appalachians. There is very limited public transit here. I walk a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also in better health than most of the people in my generation. But the thing is, yes, you have to make some changes and some sacrifices in order to get by without a car, but it can be done.
I actually know a
fair number of people who are doing it.
Well, and you know, but I'm thinking about, again, going back to your idea of,
mm-hmm.
of limits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you tell Americans they can't have something,
mm-hmm.
suddenly you're curtailing their rights and their freedoms,
uh-huh.
you know, even if it's, I mean, look at the flack of Michelle Obama got just
mm-hmm.
trying to get people to eat healthier,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know. I think we have been really sold a bill of goods,
yes.
you know, in the mentality that we can do whatever we want
mm-hmm.
and there
mm-hmm.
will be no consequences.
Mm-hmm. And the thing we need to learn first is that there are always consequences. And second, that many of these things that we spend all of our lives chasing, we don't actually want them. I mean, we're the first civilization in the history of the world where buildings for storing stuff.
We have
a major
so much
industry.
Junk, we can't even fit it in our house.
We can't, and we have the biggest houses in human history.
Yeah.
More square foot per person than any other civilization, and yet we have so much junk we can't even put it there. It's not as though we're using the junk.
Yeah.
It's that we're chasing it because we've convinced ourselves that that's what's going to make us happy, and when it doesn't, and it won't, and it can't, to actually face up to that, to face up to the fact that our lives have been founded on a pack of lies.
Yeah. I mean, that, and I'm thinking about the waste too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the
mm-hmm.
I mean, that just goes along with it naturally.
Very
but when
much
you
so.
You think about the money we waste, the
mm-hmm.
shit we buy that we don't
mm-hmm.
need. I mean, QVC, Home Shopper. I mean, constant bombarding people
mm-hmm.
every day. You know, you
mm-hmm.
need this. You need this. You know,
you don't need this. Yeah. I one of the things that I recommend to people by way of my blog and other things is get rid of your television.
Mm-hmm.
If you want media, you know, tune into the radio.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't when you have the television, you've got this box beaming advertisements at your brain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it amazes me how many people do not think of do not wonder why it is they call what's on television programming.
and the boob tube. Don't
boob
forget.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
The idiot
tube. They couldn't be more blatant.
Yeah.
And the thing is, most of the things that people think they want, they don't actually want. They've been taught to think that they want these things.
Well,
and,
you know, go ahead.
I'm
sorry.
No,
well,
no.
I was going to tell you, you know, when I was a young woman and
mm-hmm.
I, you know, and I grew up with that conditioning that,
mm-hmm.
You know, the thing you wanted was, you know, you wanted to get married and have a house and two cars and,
mm-hmm.
and life would be idyllic. Well, you know, I was lucky enough to get all of that very
mm-hmm.
early in life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I realized very quickly that there was this big hole inside
mm-hmm.
of me. But at least I realized that things were not
mm-hmm.
going to fill it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think that's maybe one of the most important things that isn't taught
mm-hmm.
is that things is not going to fill that, you know,
mm-hmm.
that hole that you feel inside of you when you're
mm-hmm.
laying in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that there are other more important things than things.
Yeah. And yeah, you can't fill that hole by going on another shopping spree.
Yeah.
And yet people are taught to think that that's the only way. And so there's this hamster in a wheel routine
mm-hmm.
where people are running top speed trying to fill the hole and they're getting nowhere. Because
yeah.
it's not about stuff. And, you know, you can get all the stuff you want and it's not going to matter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, John, let me ask you, one of the
mm-hmm.
other things we were going to talk about was mystery teachings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, what do you mean by mystery teachings?
Okay, well, in as far as we know, every society, every human society and throughout history, there have been schools, we can call them mystery schools, which have taught various ways to approach the world in from a wider perspective. And they teach things, they've always taught things such as meditation, ritual, various things like that, methods for expanding consciousness, and certain philosophical ideas, certain ways of looking at the world that foster that kind of expanded awareness. Those are the mystery schools, and the teachings that they teach are the mystery teachings. You can give them many other names, and they've had many other names. It's just that from the background that where I had my training, that's what we call them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I wanted to do when I was putting together the spiritual ecology book was precisely, how am I going to talk about this in a way that isn't going to be sectarian, isn't going to be, you know, this one school or that one school or the other school over there? And the old phrase mystery teaching seemed to me to really sum that up. Because it's not just one school, it's not just one system. There is no one best version.
Mm-hmm.
You know, best for any given person, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's what I was talking about. It's partly
so sort of cherry picking the universal wisdom, so to
mm-hmm.
speak.
Well, also recognizing that there is a universal wisdom that expresses itself in many different ways,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
that all of those expressions are mystery schools, and they're mystery schools partly because there's very often a little bit of secrecy around them, and partly because they deal with the great mysteries of existence.
Mm-hmm.
So that was why I used that label. Also, I had been dealing with various people who were getting on my case for being an evil, satanic something or other. You've probably encountered this yourself. These sort of people for whom anything other than their particular line of ideology is evil incarnate.
I had been
fielding some stuff from them, and they were talking about mystery this and mystery that. And so I suppose part of it was that I was going, okay, you want mystery, I'll give you mystery.
Well, now, I think in your book you talk about seven laws of spiritual ecology. What are the seven laws?
Okay, the seven laws of spiritual ecology, and I should say this is, there's nothing like uniquely true about this. It has been a custom in Western mystery schools for a long time now to express the basic notions of the mystery philosophy in seven laws. Probably a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the Kabbalion, which has which has seven laws, and there are various other versions of this. So the laws that I worked out on the basis of ecology to talk about what ecology has to say about spirituality, the law of wholeness, which is simply that all things are part of a common unity. Nothing is separate, nothing is set apart. There's no rigid boundaries separating any two things in the cosmos. Everything participates in everything else.
Sort of like that, we're the microcosm of the macrocosm.
We're the microcosm of the macrocosm, and so is everything else. We're not uniquely microcosmic. You know, a rock, a hawk, a blue-green algae, a photosynthesizing, and the like are all microcosms of the macrocosm. We all participate in them at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the second one is the law of flow, which is that everything that exists is created and sustained by flows of matter, energy, and information that come out of the whole system and return to the whole system. It's not about accumulation. It's not about building up a mass of stuff. It's about participating in flow.
So it's more like the ocean, sort of, an ebb and flow.
Yeah, very much so. And when you try to cling too hard to something, you're basically blocking the flow, and you're going to cause the usual blockages that blocking the flow have, you know, the usual difficulties blocking any kind of flow have.
Whether you're talking about chi or money or crap,
your digestive process, you do not want to hold on to things. the law of balance, which is that everything exists by being in balance with itself, with other things, and with the whole system. Okay? And also, that balance is not going to one extreme or the other, and it's not remaining stuck in the middle. It's usually a cyclical movement back and forth to either side of a midpoint, like a pendulum.
That's
where balance is really found.
Yeah.
Okay. The fourth law is the law of limits. There's that word again.
There you go. I like that though.
Everything that exists is subject to limits.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the limits come from its own nature. Some of it's the nature of the whole system. Some of it's from the nature of existence itself. These limits are not there to be gotten rid of. They're the foundation of existence. They're the foundation of beauty and power. If you've ever wondered why so much modern architecture is so ugly, it's that so many architects are taught to try to overcome all limits. And generally, if the people say, "Oh, I want to overcome all limits," well, you know, the chair you're sitting on is limiting your propensity to fall toward the floor. Okay, your skin is limiting, and your tissues are limiting your blood's ability to just flow out of your body and pool on the ground. A human being with all limits removed would not be some kind of superhuman being. He would be a puddle of red slush.
Well, but I'm also thinking about, too, and maybe this is sort of the same but a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm thinking about personal boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it feels like to me people have forgotten about personal boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have, like, you know, all of the sex abuse, the domestic violence, the, you know, oppression and exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that these all haven't always been problems, but you don't hear anybody talking about limits, boundaries. You know, it's almost like those things are politically incorrect.
They are. We Americans are allergic to limits, and that's one of the reasons why we're making such a mess of things.
One of my listeners is she keeps asking me to ask you, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but she wants to know if you've read Rudolf Steiner's work on spiritual ecology.
Actually, I've read quite a bit of Steiner.
I think she's looking for feedback from you on his work, if you have any comments.
Oh, yeah. Steiner has been a significant influence on my own work. I wouldn't call myself an anthroposophist. That's the school that he founded. But he has influenced my thinking quite a bit. His system does seem to work. And in particular, one of the things that I appreciate about Steiner's work is that his stuff has practical applications. If you take his philosophy and you apply it to growing vegetables in your garden, and it works.
Mm-hmm.
And this has always struck me as important, because it's very easy to spin philosophies. It's, you know, easy to just sit there and say, well, this and this and this and this all off in the astral plane or something. But when you can actually do something with it, where it can be tested, where
mm-hmm.
it matters, you know, right down here in the material plane where we can watch,
mm-hmm.
that's impressive to me. So, yeah, I think Steiner is a good resource. There
okay.
are some places where I think that... you know, as with anyone else, I don't think that he has the whole picture. But I certainly don't, for that matter.
So, she's saying something about biodynamic farming.
Biodynamic farming and gardening. That's the practical applications that I was mentioning. And, in fact, I use a certain amount of biodynamic principles in my own backyard vegetable garden.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah.
All right, so you've said, okay, so of your seven laws, you've got wholeness, balance, flow, limits.
Wholeness, flow, balance, and limits. Okay, so that gives us four. And now you'll notice in these sets of seven, typically the fourth one, the central one, is the hinge around which everything else pivots. And that's true in this case. Once you grasp the law of limits, then things start unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth one is the law of cause and effect.
Okay.
Which is a little subtler than it may seem. Basically, everything happens because of a cause, and every cause leads to an effect. Or
mm-hmm.
rather, everything happens from causes, plural, and has effects.
Mm-hmm.
What you do draws on things from the past, feeds into things in the future. Now, there's always got to be a similarity of kind between the effect and at least one of the causes. Okay? You can have a heated argument. It's not going to light the pilot light of your furnace.
Right.
If you want a flame on the material plane, you've got to do something on the material plane. If
mm-hmm.
you want the flame of passion or the flame of inspiration, you've got to do something on those flames, on those
mm-hmm.
planes, rather.
Right.
And similarly, there has to be a similarity of scale between the effect and the sum total of its causes. You're not
so in other
going to,
words, if you only put a little bit out, you're only going to get a little bit back.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Okay,
and so
if you don't work hard, don't expect a lot of reward.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what I call the lottery law, okay? Everybody I know who has gotten really deep into fantasizing about winning the lottery, their lives have stopped. They've just kind of sat there spinning their wheels. And waiting to win. And everything just screeches to a halt around them, because the universe, I think, is trying to tell them, no, that's not the way you do it. If you want something to happen wonderful in your life, make it.
Yes. Yes.
Go out there and make it happen.
And that's what you're talking about, where we create our own reality.
We participate in the creation of our own realities.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
we also, of course, we participate in the creation of other people's realities, and they
yeah.
in ours.
Yeah.
So there's this constant, it's flow. There's this
yeah.
constant flow going on.
Right, right.
Okay, the sixth law is the law of the planes. And that's suggesting that everything in existence exists and functions on one or more of several different planes of being. The planes are discrete and not continuous. That's an old magical law. The point is, again, you know, you can have a heated argument and it's not going to cook the food.
Mm-hmm.
You have to. There are ways to move energies and influences from plane to plane, from the material plane, the emotional plane, the mental plane, however else you want to divide it. But you can't count on that movement unless you understand how you're making it and actually make it happen.
Okay.
And so paying attention to what plane something is happening on is very important, and what plane you're taking action on. It's important, for example, to understand ecological principles, but it's also important to enact them in your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can,
mm-hmm.
we were talking about this, it's great if you have this you know, devotion to the Mother Goddess of the Earth, okay? But if you're still climbing into the SUV and driving all by yourself 3 blocks each way to the grocery store,
right. Yeah,
you maybe need to think about how far that devotion extends.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then the final law is the law of these seven laws that I have here is the law of evolution.
Okay.
And that's a little subtle, because evolution very often is used in modern times. Actually, it's been misused this way since Darwin first coined the term as a synonym for progress.
Mm.
You know, everything's getting better and better. Well, no, actually. Everything
yeah.
is adapting. Everything is changing and flowing. And it doesn't follow a predetermined line of development. There is no fixed, this is where it's going.
Okay.
It's more a matter of exploration, reaching out, expanding the range of possibilities and the diversity of options available. And that's true in human spiritual development. If you have, you know, if you look back on your own life and you think, you know, of different stages of your own personal evolution, I'm sure one of the things you'll notice is that the further you go, the wider your options become.
Yeah.
The more you come to understand, the more you realize, well, I could do this, and I could do this, and I could actually do this here that I've never done before and would never have thought of doing, but, you know, I could give that a try, too.
Well, and I think the more you know, the more you realize how much you don't know.
And so, to pick on the Republicans again briefly.
Go right ahead.
You know, they understand very little. And so it all seems very simple and straightforward to them.
Yeah, it's like they live in this little black and white box.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And because, and they cling to the box because outside it's very scary.
Very scary. Yeah, they're
very
fear-based people.
Yeah, yeah. And then you step outside and then you all and I've known people who've done this, who've come out of that kind of background and have kind of crept out and looked around and said, well, it's not as scary as I thought. And pretty soon they, like, get used to it. But, yeah, the more certain you are that you're right, very likely, the less you actually understand the situation.
Well, and the less likely you are to examine anything either because you have such certainty about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, John, we're starting to run out of time, and I have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you can sum it up quickly, but what does spiritual ecology teach us about magic and about the future?
Okay. Very simply, with regard to magic, spiritual ecology teaches us that it's not about something for nothing. You can use spiritual effects to transform your life, but it's hard work. It's not, you know, you go to a weekend workshop and all of a sudden you have these marvelous powers and you're an ascended master or something.
Yeah, you'd see a lot more rich pagans, wouldn't you?
You'd think so. Yeah, but so in fact, it's slow going. It is an effective way of work, but the word is work. With regard to the future, we as a society have backed ourselves into a corner in a lot of ways. We have made a lot of mistakes and drawn a lot of conclusions that really can't be justified and invested a lot of time and a lot of emotion, a lot of energy in things that do not work. And those are not going away just because we don't like them anymore. So we've got a mess. That doesn't mean that we can all say, well, you know, everything's going to be blown to smithereens and that's all there is. That's a cop-out. It's a very popular cop-out, but it's still a cop-out. You know, the idea is that if everything's, you know, blown up in one vast fireball, then at least we can claim it wasn't our fault. And so we need to get past that, frankly.
And so what is the answer?
We need to start with personal with what's going on in our own lives. We have to start with our own choices. We have to live our lives in the reflection of what we claim to believe. And once we can do that, once we can actually start grappling with the day-to-day realities of our world and of our experience, and do it from a spiritual point of view and say, okay, you know, I'm not going to take the SUV to the grocery store three blocks. I'm actually going to walk it. Or you know, there are many, many, many other examples.
Yeah,
but
yeah, absolutely. So
yeah,
it's walking our talk. You know,
walking
really,
our talk. You've got to start there.
Yeah.
It's what Rainer Maria Rilke wrote in his sonnet on the statue of Apollo. Du musst dein Leben ändern. You must change your life.
Yeah.
And as we do that, we gain the power to change the world.
It's maybe that tipping point, that morphic field, that hundredth monkey idea.
Yeah,
you know?
But also simply, I think a lot of people are terrified. They know they have to change. They want to change. There's no examples. There's nobody showing them how it can be done. Like me, I'm not owning a car. I know a fair number of people who, having watched the process and learned, got a little advice, have ended up either leaving their cars in their garage for a lot of the time or getting rid of them because they need to see that somebody can do it.
Yeah, yeah. They need leaders. There are too many sheeple.
There's just people are afraid, and they're afraid. And there has been so much in the way of people who have been making these grand pronouncements that they don't live by.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of bad out there.
Yeah.
And so people are rightly concerned about that. And that's why those of us who understand this need to start by walking our talk.
Well, John, it's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. I'm so glad you
you came on tonight. Lots of really good stuff, and I'm sorry we have to, you know, cut it off. I could talk to you for another half hour. But listeners, we're talking to John Michael Greer, and his website is aoda.org. Look him up on the web. You will find many of his books. He's got 10 out there. And thank you so much, John.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
And if anything ever comes up and you'd like to be back on the show and share some more of your insights, please have your wife get in touch.
I will keep you posted.
Okie doke. Good night.
Okay. Good night.
Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that. I know I did.
Most people see humankind as really separate from nature and separate from the earth. I'm as much of this earth as a rock or a tree is. When I came out of it, this is my mother planet. I grew out of this earth.
As long as we conceive of divinity as above us or outside of us, or that our bodies are somehow less divine than spirit, there's no way that we can change our course.
Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, the rolling grass hills, strength of her spine, mountains, tall backs. Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. These are the beautiful opening words from Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia is a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality, and about connecting with the earth and ways to do that. It gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. It's also visually stunning, and the DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet, and it's only $20, and that's from DancingWithGaia.com. I hope you'll check it out. I've actually seen it, listeners, and it is very, very good. I wanted to share with you before the end of the show about Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, or some people called her the Purse. Please sit back for a minute while I read this to you. This week you are no doubt hearing everywhere about how Margaret Thatcher is the pride of England, how as a woman she rose to heights no one imagined might be possible. Starting out the daughter of a shopkeeper living over their store, she fought through the ranks to become Prime Minister of England for over a decade. And of course, we are all sorry for her passing and offer our respects as we would with most anyone that passes on. However, let us examine her legacy and what her leadership actually meant to the people of England. I'd invite you to check in with your friends in England, see if they're mourning her passing, or if, like my friends across the pond, they more likely remember the suffering she caused them. A conservative and friend of former President Ronald Reagan, she was responsible, as was he, for beginning to unravel the social safety net in their countries. She believed there is no society, there are only individuals. Sound familiar? The Ayn Rand, Paul Ryan, Tea Party, rugged individualism mantra that would have half the country living under a bridge, Social Security cut below a living wage, and Medicare a voucher program that would buy nothing. Pull up the old videos. They're available on the Internet. See the riots in the street that occurred when she went after labor and working class people. She was also anti-gay and on the wrong side of history. She and Reagan ushered in a tone of greed is good, rather than the ideal leaders or an office to see to the common good and general welfare of all their people. She, like Reagan, was for the corporation, not the worker, though both may have couched their language to dupe the public into thinking the changes they were instituting were actually good for everyone. The truth is, the result of their leadership has led us here and in England to being two countries with the largest income disparity among its people, which adversely affects women and children most severely. Margaret Thatcher eventually paid the price for her desire for more austerity and more privatization. Her own party threw her out of office because the people were in revolt. So when you remember Margaret Thatcher and you hear how she was a pioneer for women, well, that might be in a sense. But would you want Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann leading the country simply because we share the same genitalia? Of course not. It's the policies of politicians we care about. We care about how their beliefs affect society and culture. Do they care about everyone or just a select few? Do they believe greed is good and anyone not rich, well, maybe they're just lazy and don't work hard enough? Margaret Thatcher would probably be right at home with right-wing conservatives and Tea Party folks. I can actually see her tipping a cup with Mitt Romney, Rush Limbaugh, and Paul Ryan. No wonder she despised liberals who truly are on the side of people, workers, women, and the common good. Well, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that, and if you want a copy of it, you can find it on my blog, Herstory with Karen Tate. Next week, our guests are Julie McIntyre. She's going to be chatting about her book, Sex and the Intelligence of the Heart, and Susan Shumsky discussing instant healing. I want to remind you to please remember the two F's. Please click the follow button on my show page so you get news of who's on the show each week without having to rely on getting a reminder email from me. And please, I invite you to click on Friend and become a friend of the show and become part of the international voices of the Sacred Feminine Family. Also, remember, please, you can catch any show from the archives. You don't have to listen live, and you can listen via iTunes as well. And as we come to the close of tonight's show, I think we've talked about a lot of ideas that are very foreign to a lot of people, which is why these are our two mottos. The first is by the German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. He said, all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. And Gandhi said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Remember, listeners, please check out my website. I'm available to give a talk to your group or teach a weekend workshop. There's also lots of free stuff on my website, meditations you can download, classes on my YouTube channel, articles, great resources. Learn about my two books and check out the Goddess Greeting Cards and Sistra, which are sacred rattles of the Egyptian goddesses we have available in the Goddess Store. And please remember what Mother Nature teaches us. What you nurture and tends to survives and thrives. What you neglect withers on the vine. That's true in every facet of your life, from your health, your work, your passion, your lovers, your family. And in that thought, if you can, please send a donation to help keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. You know, listeners, airtime is no longer free to hosts like myself. I pay for the airtime to share with the community and give others a platform to share their work with listeners. So if you'd like to help me stay on the air, I'd appreciate it if you would go to my website, KarenTate.com. Once there, click on the Goddess Store page, and you will find PayPal buttons to make donations in any amount. And I guess I would just say, please remember some of the values we talked about tonight. Our resources are not infinite. There are limits to everything. We do have to be very careful, and we do have to walk our talk. So good night, my dear friends, fans, family, and colleagues. May Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. And as we close off the show tonight with a little bit of music, how about I let you listen to Alay Adeo and her cut called Time Stood Still?